While the American people are sitting on a powder keg, many of us realize if things keep going the way they're going, this thing is going to blow sky high. There might come a time when we have to defend ourselves, especially if governors and mayors continue to do nothing to stop the onslaught of violence. Thank you. I want to show you two pictures. Sean, do you have the first picture up for me? This is a little hard to see. This is a hostile crowd of BLMers who cornered a lady by the name of Lauren Victor in a Washington, D.C. restaurant on August 26th. They wanted her and everybody else in the restaurant to raise their fists in support of the BLM movement. And what's really funny is Lauren Victor is a supporter of the BLM movement, but she did not raise her fist when everybody else in the restaurant did. Her reward for non-compliance was to have "white silence is violence" screamed in her face. When that didn't seem to budge her, one BLMer accused Mrs. Victor of not even being a Christian. Sean, pop up the next picture for me, will you? This is Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old who shot three people, two of whom died in Kenosha, Wisconsin. What this teenager was doing somewhere he shouldn't have been, having a weapon that he should not have had, is yet to be answered. But this is not the question for today. The question that needs to be answered in court is, did Rittenhouse act in self-defense? What is the biblical position on self-defense? Are we allowed to defend ourselves? Is God cool with that? Given the unpredictability and the violence of the crimes being committed in our streets, I think it's high time to have this discussion so that we all know what God expects of us if someone tries to harm us or the people we love, if someone tries to damage our property or steal it from us, what can we do? When it comes to self-defense, should we sit it out like Lauren Victor or shoot it out like Kyle Rittenhouse? To answer this, we have to go all the way back to Noah. God told Noah that human life is important and there's a price that must be paid for taking one of those lives. Reading from Genesis 9:6, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed, for God made man in his own image." God's meaning here is very clear. Human life is precious, and God exacts the ultimate penalty for taking a life. This does not address self-defense per se, but it establishes a very foundational principle that human life is sacred and it is to be protected. Making sure that we got the message that human life is sacred, God provides a reason that one of those lives can be justifiably taken. It's for self-defense. Reading from Exodus 22, 2 and 3. "If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him, for he shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft." What this means is, if a thief breaks in during the day and you kill him, you're guilty of murder. If, however, he breaks in at night and you kill him, you're not. God gives citizens the latitude in the middle of the night when you can be taken over very quickly because you're sound asleep. What this Old Testament law tells us is that we can defend ourselves in our own homes if we have to use justifiable force and only under certain circumstances. Other scriptures endorse self-defense. Nehemiah rebuilt Jerusalem in the face of murderous opposition. Tribal neighbors looked for ways to carry out deadly attacks on the Jews. The people were instructed in Nehemiah 4:14, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." The pinnacle of the book of Esther revolves around the Jews acting in self-defense. The Persians hated the Jews, and they hatched a genocidal plot against them. When the plot was discovered, the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. Esther 8:11. It is clear from these passages that the Bible supports self-defense. Jesus advises his disciples to go get themselves a sword. Luke 22:36. Let the one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. Now, why would Jesus, the nicest man on the planet, tell his disciples to go get a sword? Because they, like us, were living in very dangerous times. When Jesus said this, it had become especially dangerous for him and his disciples. And the implication here is clear. Defend yourself. The idea that we're supposed to let bad people harm us or our families, our neighbors, or even strangers is completely alien to the scriptures. The controversy about self-defense in the Christian community mainly revolves around a mistranslated commandment. It is the sixth one. And most people, if they're asked, what is this commandment, they'll say, thou shalt not kill. And then they'll say, there it is, I told you so. Well, God did not say, you shall not kill. God specifically said, you shall not murder. And there's a very big difference. Thou shalt not kill is the King James translation of the sixth commandment. The King James translators didn't try to get this commandment wrong. Over 400 years ago, kill was synonymous with murder. The English language has changed since 1610, and some words that used to be synonyms aren't anymore. In fact, some words don't even mean the same thing that they used to mean. Both Hebrew and English have two words for taking a life. One is kill, and the other is murder. The difference between the two is profound. Killing has several meanings. Taking any life, whether it be a human's or an animal's. Taking a human life deliberately or by accident. Taking a human life legally or illegally, morally or immorally. But murder has one meaning and one meaning only, the illegal or immoral taking of a human life. This is why you're never going to see wall-to-wall news coverage of someone being charged with first-degree murder of a mosquito. When you swat a mosquito that has landed on your arm, you have killed it. You have not murdered it. If this commandment really did say kill, we would not be allowed to have hamburgers at Culver's. We wouldn't be able to have chicken parmesan at Marciano's. We would have to be vegetarians. And we would also have to be pacifists because we could not kill, not even in self-defense. The Ten Commandments were etched on two tablets. The commandments etched on the second tablet revolve around our treatment of our fellow human beings. And the first one on that list is do not murder. The reason do not murder is the first one on the list is because murder is the worst thing one person can do to another person. This is why it is really important that we understand that the commandment prohibits murder and not all killing. When people try to equate killing and self-defense to murder, they leave others helpless in the face of danger. They put people who would defend their life and the lives of others on the same level as terrorists. An argument posed by people who haven't clearly read the Bible is, well, Jesus would not have supported self-defense because Jesus was a pacifist. Was he? I don't really think so. Pacifism was never part of the Jewish life or culture. The rabbis taught the people that if someone was coming to kill you and you figured it out beforehand, you should strike first. They also taught if someone else was in danger of being killed by an attacker, you should jump on the attacker and let him have it. In light of this, we can safely hypothesize that Rabbi Jesus would have never espoused pacifism. The reason we think Jesus was a pacifist is because many of his sayings have been misunderstood and taught to the church in this way. When we view Jesus' sayings in their Jewish context, we have to come to other conclusions. Many people over the years have seen Jesus as a pacifist, and for good reason. Here is a man who is apparently willing to die rather than to defend himself. Here's a man who taught his disciples not to kill, to resist evil, to love their enemies, not to fear those who could physically hurt them, that only those who are willing to lose their lives could keep them. Jesus' teachings seem an awful lot like those of the popular pacifist Gandhi. The most popular saying of Jesus that folks use to support the idea that he was a pacifist comes from Matthew 5:39. "But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other cheek also." When Jesus' statement is read in the language that he was speaking, it is an obvious variation of Psalm 37:1 and 8. "Do not fret because of those who are evil, or be envious of those who do wrong. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret, it only leads to evil." Jesus was not teaching that we would stand by blinking stupidly with our arms at our sides while somebody beats the tar out of us or tries to kill us. This is what is taught in some pulpits, but Jesus is not even remotely suggesting this. Rather, he was saying we should not let another person's evil consume us. We should not seek revenge. We should turn away from the evil person or resist him, depending on the situation. If Jesus really was a pacifist, then explain this passage from John 2:13 through 16. "When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, 'Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market.'" We know from other gospel texts that this incident happened on a Monday. It figures this would happen on a Monday, doesn't it? Mondays are notorious for being bad days. If something is going to happen that's not a good thing, it's going to happen on Monday. So here's Jesus on a Monday having a bad day. The money changers and the animal salesmen are ripping people off right in the temple. They charged bloated prices for the animals because they knew the people had to have them for sacrifices. And Jesus was having none of it. There was nothing passive in this text about Jesus. The scriptures tell us it is morally wrong to tolerate evil. When we allow someone to act evilly towards us, we are enabling them. And you all know what I think of enabling. We are morally obligated to defend our lives and the lives of others around us. Human life, in all of its forms, is precious in the sight of God. Jesus never taught that it was wrong to defend ourselves or others. However, Jesus was quick to point out that even in our resistance of evil, we must continue to show love to the evildoer. It is truly a balancing act. In the end, self-defense may actually be one of the greatest examples of human love. Christ himself said, "Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." John 15:14. When protecting one's family or neighbor, a Christian is unselfishly risking his or her life for the sake of others. Theologians J.P. Moreland and Norman Geiser say that to permit murder when one could have prevented it is morally wrong. To allow a rape when one could have been hindered is evil. To watch an act of cruelty to children without trying to intervene is morally inexcusable. In brief, not resisting evil is an evil of omission, and an evil of omission can be just as evil as an evil of commission. How can the story of 9/11 be told without recounting the selfless defensive actions of Todd Beamer, Mark Bingham, Tom Burnett, and Jeremy Glick? The passengers on United Airlines Flight 93 learned that the World Trade Center had been attacked with hijacked airplanes. Putting two and two together, Beamer, Bingham, Burnett, and Glick realized that their plane was another one of these hijacked planes headed for yet one more target. Beamer, Bingham, Burnett, and Glick had called their wives and told them, "Don't worry, we're going to do something, and we're going to stop this." The men together formulate a plan to overtake the hijackers. After praying the Lord's Prayer with a dispatcher, Beamer pronounces the words which have become famous, "Let's roll." They broke into the cockpit and fought for control of the plane. They succeeded in stopping the terrorists from flying the plane into the Capitol, but they could not keep the plane in the air. Beamer, Bingham, Burnett, and Glick died that day, as well as all of the rest of the passengers on that flight. But in death, they saved countless lives on the ground that day. No right-thinking person, no mature person, argues whether or not it was moral for these men to use lethal force that day. When it comes to self-defense, it's prudent for us to really think it out. And it is also wise for us to know what state laws are regarding self-defense and defense of property. There's something called the Castle Doctrine or the Castle Law and Stand Your Ground. We should know what these are, and I'm going to leave that to you to do your own homework. And we should carefully devise plans in the event that if we are attacked or if someone tries to break into our houses, we should know what we're going to do. The spur of the moment is not that time. Jim and I have already been talking about what would happen if we are in the middle of something. And it changes because now we're raising Olivia. She's not even 2 years old. I'll tell you what, our actions are going to be different than if it was just the two of us. As I think about self-defense as it pertains to just me, two scenarios play out. In one scenario, it's me against an assailant. If I have to use lethal force, I have to consider the fact that I may be dispatching my attacker to hell. If he gets me first, I'm going to heaven. This is something I'm seriously contemplating. In the second scenario, others are in danger. If it comes down to innocent people or the assailant, dispatching him to hell may be the moral action. To me, one is an easier decision than another. It may be that we never have to defend ourselves in a lethal way, and I hope and pray it never ever comes to that. There are common sense things that we can do to prevent ourselves from being put in a very bad situation. We can make sure that all of our outside lights are working. We can have secure locks on our doors and windows. And providing that the police haven't been defunded, we can call 911. Here at the church, even before this happened, we instituted security things. We have cameras on the church. We have lights on the church. I personally carry a little mace when I'm in the building by myself. Not because I'm afraid something's going to happen, but if something does, I'm ready. I'm ready to slow somebody down. These are all things that you need to think about in this day and age. But if necessary, biblically, we can defend ourselves, our family, and our friends, especially if lives are at stake. As we search through the pages of the New Testament, we see that there were times when Jesus defended himself, and there were times that he did not. Today we're going to celebrate Holy Communion. And when we celebrate Holy Communion, we must remember that this observance comes from a time when Jesus willingly chose not to defend himself. He willingly chose to go to the cross, to suffer and die for our sins. On this day, we must thank him that he did not defend himself, because he could have. He could have. And we would not have the salvation that we enjoy today. Dear Jesus, we thank you for your selfless act that you suffered and died on the cross for our sins. We thank you. Amen.